Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in November 2024. This session was titled, How Are New Regulations and Policy Developments Reshaping the Ingredient Supply Chain? Your host is Ed Ayton, Sustainability Advisor at Abel & Cole.
Please give me a warm welcome to Chris West. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed, and thanks for having me, everybody. Pleasure to be here. So my name's Chris West. I'm a researcher, actually, at the University of York, where I've been for a while, but I work on a program called TRACE, which some of you at least might be familiar with, which is a program developed by the organization that I work for, the Stockholm Environment Institute, as part of the University of York, along with Global Canopy, an NGO, based in Oxford. TRACE is basically a platform that brings together the variety of public data sets to shed light on deforestation risk in international supply chains. And we've been, quite influential in shaping some of the narrative around supply chain transparency and deforestation risk in our own right, but have also spent a lot of time thinking about the challenges in this regard, including some work with government. At the moment, for example, I'm supporting some of the discussions going on in government on the forest risk commodities regulations, particularly with regard to its monitoring systems, and also I've done some work with Belgium as well. And previously I've been involved with other platforms and programmes such as the UK's Global Resource Initiative and also the UK's Soy Manifesto. Today, though, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the incoming regulations around deforestation, primarily the EUDR, which is the one, of course, that we have most information about. But I wanted to start with a bit of a background and overview of what the UK's deforestation footprint actually looks like. And according to our data, at least, we think that about the UK is exposed to around 15,500 hectares of deforestation per year just via its direct trade. And if we account for all of the economic activity in the UK, that's about 30,000 hectares. Now, that's less than 1% of global deforestation linked to some of these agri-commodity production systems that we care about. And total deforestation annually is around 4.5 million hectares, which is about 6.3 million cricket pitches. We had a cricket pitch analogy earlier, so I thought I'd use that one as well. So actually, the UK is a relatively small player when it comes to its deforestation exposure, but obviously our population isn't that great either compared to some of the global economies. So we're a bit more deforestation efficient, if you like, than some other countries around the world, but still have an important part to play. If we look at the breakdown of that deforestation footprint, again, this probably won't be surprising to many of you, but we see some key commodities emerging, particularly things like cattle and soy from Brazil. Cocoa has become, I think, an increasingly important source of deforestation exposure to the UK, particularly with Côte d'Ivoire there being a major exporting country. And then we've got palm oil from Indonesia and Papua New Guinea being one of the key sources of risk as well. If we look at how this deforestation profile is changing over time, we can see that actually it has come down from the perspective of the UK's footprint. It's more than halved, actually, over the last 15, 20 years. However, it has remained relatively stubborn in recent years, basically coming down to a bit of a plateau. So obviously, the work that has been done to try and reduce that deforestation has been somewhat effective. I'll turn to some of that work in a second, but there still remains some work to be done on this front. Now, this problem of deforestation linked to our imports and our supply chains in general is not a new one. In fact, the Consumer Goods Forum, of course, came out in 2010 with a statement to achieve net zero deforestation by 2020 in key sectors. The Consumer Goods Forum is for those of you who don't know, is a sort of collection of major international retail and manufacturing companies primarily. They didn't meet those targets, self-evidently, but it did help to raise the profile of this in the private sector and also in the public sector as well. In 2014, the New York Declaration of Forests brought together a number of international actors, including governments, the private sector, and NGOs, again with commitments emerging around zero deforestation, this time by 2030. And off the back of that, we saw in the EU this Amsterdam Declarations partnership emerging, which brought together a number of major EU economies to support private sector in deforestation free. More recently, we had that UK Global Resource Initiative that proposed a series of measures within the UK to reduce the deforestation risk of the UK. And that included the suggestion for a due diligence process within the UK, which the government then took on board, and it did implement that for the supply chain in 2021, which was the same year that the COP in Glasgow took place, which also brought together world leaders to provide more financial support for producer countries to ending deforestation. And then more latterly still, we've seen the introduction, of course, of the EUDR, the EU Deforestation Regulation, which came into force in 2023 with an implementation date of the end of this year. I'll come back to that in a second. This year, we also saw this corporate sustainability due diligence regulation coming in as well, which has some interaction with the EUDR. So that's a bit of a potted history. As I said, some of that has helped to reduce the deforestation that's going on globally and also the risk that's associated with the supply chains of the EU and the UK. But it has been a rather mixed picture as well. So we've seen in recent years, in the last decade or so, palm oil deforestation reducing per quantity of output. However, in most recent years, that's also started to increase again as well. So we think a lot of that's due to domestic demand. So Indonesia itself is a large consumer of its own palm oil. But that's something, a bit of a warning sign there, that these things are not necessarily always moving in the right direction. In contrast, in the Amazon, we had seen in the last sort of administration, Bolsonaro administration, deforestation rates increasing, but with the new administration, Lula administration in Brazil, those have started to come down again. So it just goes to show how policy change in these regions of production can be as important or even more important than policy change in the supply chain. Just turning attention to the actual regulations that apply to supply chains then, the pathway for those has also not been particularly smooth, I would say. The legislation in the UK, the Forest Risk Commodities legislation, was introduced in 2021 as part of the Environment Act. We're still awaiting the secondary legislation that will actually put this into force. There are very scant details on what that will actually mean for the supply chain, and I think some frustration in all quarters on the fact that this has been so slow, not least from the private sector, of course, who have been in many cases pushing for this to come through. And on the European side, those of you following this will know that there has recently been a proposal for a delay of 1 year, which looks like it will go through, be accepted. There have also been some recent proposals for amendments to the legislation, which look like they might not go through. I'll come back to that in a second. So just comparing the two regulations then, just as a sort of general background on these, and I think this sort of intercomparison is helpful for guiding some of the discussions that will follow. Around the challenges, we can see that these two regulations are quite different from one another, actually. They're both focused on deforestation risk commodities. They're both focused on due diligence processes. But actually, if you were going to design two processes, they couldn't actually be too much different in some ways. In terms of implementation, looks like now, as I said, the EUDR would be implemented at the end of next year, 2025, rather. The UK regs, we have absolutely no idea at this stage. Regulatory scope, quite a lot of contrast here. The UK's regulations apply to legality, so they are focused on forest risk commodities, selection of forest risk commodities, but they focus explicitly on whether those commodities have been produced in compliance with local land-related laws. The EUDR, on the other hand, focuses primarily on the deforestation aspect, so the idea is that you're proving in the supply chain, or doing your best to prove that your supply chains are free from actual deforestation activity post a 2020 cutoff date. And they also include provisions for legality as well, but the provisions there are wider in scope as well than the UK regulation. The commodity coverage is different. There are more commodities included in the EUDR. There are also subtle differences associated with how one treats those commodities in the supply chain. So for the UK side, it can be any material really that's associated with those production systems that's in scope. So if you're feeding chickens feeds, which contains at some point soy, technically that may be included in the UK regulations. That's chicken being sold on the market in the EU would not directly be included in the regulations, but the supply chain for that chicken feed would be. Company coverage is also different. The UK includes all large businesses handling over 500 tonnes of material, and it excludes any domestic production activities, mainly because we don't produce much of those commodities, apart from cattle, of course. On the other hand, the EU applies to what they call operators and traders. So these are organisations that place material on the market specifically, and that includes small businesses as well. And it also includes domestic production systems. And then it comes to the actual requirements on the supply chain. Again, the UK is rather vague on what this will require. We believe it will require some sort of due diligence statement in the public domain, or at least part of it in the public domain, but that's yet to be fully confirmed. The EUDR is much more specific in terms of what it's requiring. Geolocation of plots for all commodities, all products, has been the most controversial, one of the most controversial angles to this. And that will be supplemented by a due diligence statement, with the level of that statement varying depending on whether a country is classified as high standard or low risk. And just at the bottom there, there was this proposal as recently as last week for a no-risk category, which would essentially remove regulatory requirements, but it doesn't look like it's going to come through. So just to finish there are, of course, a multitude of challenges associated with these regulations. I should stress that they have been, I would say, broadly welcomed as relatively progressive and influential, or having the potential for being very influential in terms of the UK's and EU's deforestation exposure. They've certainly been welcomed as an opportunity to level the playing field when it comes to attention on the supply chain. However, they are not without their challenges, and they have not come without complaint. So, for example, we still await the EUDR's risk benchmarking process, which will determine the degree to which due diligence will be required. That's been one of the key criticisms levelled against the EUDR recently, which has led in part to its delay, the fact that this hasn't been ready. And obviously that uncertainty remains and means that businesses really don't know what level of due diligence they need to conduct in certain locations around the world. We obviously have the implications of the Northern Ireland and Ireland border, with Ireland having to comply with the EUDR, Northern Ireland possibly having to comply with the EUDR, we still don't know. So that's a big uncertainty as well. There are differing standards, and I think this has implications because a lot of companies in the UK, of course, will be caught up in both regulations, either directly or indirectly. If they're a large company, certain divisions may be selling directly to the EU market, in which case you may be complying with two sets of regulations. Even if you're not directly selling on the market, but you're an intermediate supplier to the EU and who is selling something on the market, that may still require you to supply evidence to that company as part of those regulations. And that will incorporate, I guess, smaller companies as well as larger ones. Those legality definitions are a bit problematic as well, I would say, at the moment, in terms of the fact that there's not a lot of information on what this actually means. And it seems to be that in both cases, the companies themselves will be kind of looked upon to determine the degree to which they are meeting or compliant with legal frameworks in countries of production. But we all know that some of those legal frameworks are underdeveloped and under-enforced, and some what conflicting in certain circumstances. So that's not going to be easy either. And then there's the geolocation aspect. I would say that for the most part, geolocation to plot level in these supply chains is possible. Doesn't mean it's easy in all cases, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't come with changes in how sourcing is conducted. So there are changes that will happen off the back of this traceability or geolocation requirement. A big question which we'll come to in the discussion, I'm sure, is are producers ready for this, and are they being supported sufficiently to enable them to provide the evidence that supply chains require? And if they're not ready, what happens? Is there going to be a leakage effect and a bifurcation in markets where we've got some elements of the supply chain sustainable going to the EU and others which are not? I would just like to finish by saying that the regulations are not certainly a silver bullet. They don't replace the voluntary action that is often more ambitious. than what the regulations put out. They also, as I said right at the start, if we clean up the UK supply chain completely and we clean up the EU supply chain completely, that doesn't mean that the deforestation problem has gone away entirely. There is going to be a continued need for investment in production systems in countries of production, regardless of where they're exporting or producing their food for. And I think there's a key role for the UK supply chain in helping with that transition beyond their own supply chains. So I'll leave it there. Thanks very much for listening.
Thanks, Chris. If anyone has any questions, I would urge you to make a note. Your opportunity to ask them will come up in about 10, 15 minutes. Great. Noel, would you mind introducing yourself to the audience, please?
Hi, everyone. I'm Noel Tunon. I'm from the Fair Trade Foundation. I would say the Fair Trade Foundation is a certification company that works with smallholder producers in South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia.
Perfect, thank you. I've made a note here to mention Monga Bay as well. That is one of the best resources on deforestation. If you haven't heard of it, highly, highly recommend it. The Newscast podcast is fantastic. Great, let's jump into it. Chris, if I could come to you firstly, you touched on some of the challenges facing companies. I think you were leaving a bit of steam for this question here. What would you say are the main challenges facing companies with these regs, particularly around traceability and documentation?
And I think the main one ultimately is just understanding where your materials come from in the first place. And having had some experience working with companies on the voluntary side, you know, going back 5 or 6 years ago, even for commodities which have been relatively well covered from a sort of deforestation risk perspective, like palm oil, like soy, if you look at the, with the exception maybe of the major retailers, the major manufacturers, and the traders, of course, who are shipping these things around the world, if you look at the level of knowledge about where those materials are ultimately sourced from, it's typically very, very low as a baseline. So if you think about particularly the UK regs, which in theory implicate any part of the supply chain, not just those placing on the market, there's an awful lot of learning that's going to have to go on in the first instance to understand where your risks might be, and then just the process of how you go around actually identifying who's supplying, you know, tier two, tier three onwards. And that ultimately will be your responsibility under these regulations. It's not the responsibility of the person at tier four to prove that they are compliant. It's your responsibility to prove that, or to prove to the best degree possible, that you are compliant with the regulation. So that's one challenge, just the first sort of risk mapping, understanding where things are coming from. I think depending on the outcome of that, you might find that you've got a supply chain which is incredibly complex. And then the question is, well, how would you go about supporting that supply chain to actually provide you with the geolocation requirements? And that's where I think the bigger actors in this game really, really are critical, because those are the organizations, the big trading organizations like Cargill's, the ADMs, Safetra, whatever, who are ultimately importing the bulk of this material, the bulk of this deforestation risk, are going to be the ones that are holding and already do hold to a large degree that sort of information, but maybe haven't been giving it out because it's not perhaps in their best interest at the moment to do so. So it'll be interesting to see the degree to which that information and knowledge sharing starts to happen. Even there, if you've got a very indirect supply chain, you're trading on the spot market or whatever, there are challenges associated with geolocation. So I shouldn't underplay that. There are going to be significant costs in some sectors associated with that. So that's I would say the key one is the understanding of the supply chain. I think the due diligence statements themselves, probably not that challenging. Companies are used to reporting on things. It will be interesting to see how the EUDR interfaces with the Corporate Social Responsibility Directive as well, because that's where, I understand, there'll be more of a requirement to publicly publish some of that information. And what's interesting in the EUDR context is that you've got this provision for substantiated concerns as well. So if a third-party organisation comes and says, I've looked at X company's due diligence statement and this isn't proving anything, it's just rubbish, then there's a mechanism via which you can get more scrutiny from what they call competent authorities, which are the enforcers in this mix. So, yeah, a few things to grapple with.
On this note of due diligence and how easy it would be to tick that box, I see comparisons between modern slavery acts and the statements appearing on websites coming in 2015, and the whole topic stalled there and hasn't really progressed. Do you see this being a risk with EUDR as well?
The Commission's quite clear that this is not supposed to be a tick box exercise. If you look, I was looking at the frequently asked questions this morning on this, and it said explicitly, this is not a tick box exercise. So that was pretty explicit. The challenge that I see here is the volume of information that potentially will be made available to the competent authorities, as they call it. So there are basically each member state, obviously not the UK in this case, but if the UK regulations get introduced, there will be a competent authority for that as well. Each member state will have a competent authority which is responsible ultimately for checking these things. And the level of checks that they have to do will depend on the level of risk that the countries are assigned to. They have to do 9% of checks on the highest risk, which probably aren't going to be that many countries, but there could be tens of thousands of these statements coming in almost every day. So the level of scrutiny that those checks will undertake on probably at worst one person in a competent authority, at best probably 10 people in a competent authority, is going to be relatively low, I would say. And that's where I think the issue is going to be. And that's why it's quite interesting to see this other mechanism with the sort of substantiated concerns as well, because I suspect that civil society will actually take up a lot of burden when it comes to actually scrutinising some of this stuff.
I think seeing how the Green Claims Code has shaped up, I think that's got legs, definitely. On the topic of modern slavery, so I thought it was my phone, I am interested to bring the Fair Trade Foundation into this because I imagine there will be wider impacts to EUDR and its upcoming regulations. Could you maybe give some examples of things that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, for the EUDR regulations that if we brought it back to the other area, smallholders are a really important part of our food system. In two of the commodities that Chris spoke about, coffee and cocoa, which is the ones that we work with, 80% of coffee is produced by smallholder farmers and 90% of cocoa is produced by smallholder farmers. And just to put into context, that's over 30 million farmers that are included into the supply chain. So when we think about some of the challenges associated with bringing, with complying with this legislation for 30 million farmers is 30 million plots that they have to drop, they have to plot out, there are 30 million due diligence statements that they have to give to companies. And in another way, different traders or different different traders have different requirements of how they want this information. They require it in slightly different times. Sometimes they collect it themselves without the smallholders' knowledge. And that prevents the smallholders from having access to their own data to share with other members or other customers that they have. So there's a lot of areas that we need to work together with. But just to put it into context, it's not just an area of plotting the map that has significant cost associated with it. When the cost of production rising, it is a choice that smallholders have to do. Do we invest this year into mapping and a plot to comply with the legislation? Or maybe do we invest into more farmer assistance programs, maybe into different input? So it's a choice that they have to make, not necessarily to access the market as well. But there's also other barriers like language. Not all of these information is available in every single language. Sometimes, just to be frank, literacy as well. And also connectivity issues. So some of these solutions that we're speaking about today, some of these tools, some of these access are not always accessible to smallholders. So I think it's just when we are making these requirements, we're talking about it's not a tick boxing exercise, but in a lot of cases it will come to that. And those tick boxes have serious implications as well for smallholders.
I think every tick box exercise in history said we are not a tick box exercise, right? That's great. Thank you very much for that. This idea of equity, this term just transition is really coming to mind here. Chris, if we can talk about hotspotting for a little bit, how can companies identify and address potential hotspots or high-risk areas in the supply chains?
I think for starters, we know very well that the majority of deforestation is actually concentrated in certain locations around the world. So if you know that you're sourcing from a certain location in the world, then you will have a pretty good idea of whether you might be exposed to deforestation or not, just from that exercise. And you know, the tools that I'm involved with help with that sort of exercise, of course. I think the one thing that we've been pushing for a little bit on the EUDR side, although this isn't in its own right, is a little bit controversial, is the fact that we do know that even within countries there are singular or a range of different relatively concentrated patches where deforestation activity is higher. So again, once you get to the stage of identifying your country, it's not that much of a leap to say, well, am I sourcing from or am I a risk of sourcing from a particular location which is associated with that higher level of risk. I think obviously within the context of the regulation, the level of risk does not dictate whether you need geolocation. So in all cases, if you're implicated by the regulation, you still need to have that geolocation information. Ultimately, the only way of doing that is to understand and work through the supply chain to understand where your producers are located. And I think there's no alternative other than working and in dialogue with the supply chain really to get to that information. So that's the, if you come to the nub of what's required at the UDR, that's what's required to get there.
So getting that information, that traceability is the essential first step. Yep. I'm only one person with 24 hours in a day. I can't focus on every criterion sustainability that I have to. Is there quite a lot of crossover between hotspots of deforestation and hotspots where there are labour issues, modern slavery and discrimination, wage insecurity, etc.?
Definitely. And what we see, especially in cocoa-linked deforestation, is that poverty is a major driver of deforestation as well. Fairtrade has recently published a study that looks at how they use the premium to invest into productivity improvements and premium, and that's driven down deforestation and rates there. So I think there's definitely overlaps between those two areas in certain commodities. I think every commodity will have their own drivers of deforestation as well as labor abuses, and it's important to understand some of those. But I think it's bringing back to what do you do once you identify that there are hotspots risks. Do you abandon and cut and run from these supply chains as where there's a big risk of happening at the moment? Or do you work with the supply chain and take some of that human rights due diligence approach of working continuously to improve on the supply chain conditions to not outsource the issue of deforestation and human rights?
Yeah, and I think in the UDR context, it's going to be really interesting because it's clear cut. Like if you have sourced from a location after the 2020 cutoff date, you cannot place that material on the market. So if you have not undertaken that relationship with your suppliers or your whole supplier base, the implication is that a portion of those suppliers will not be allowed to provide your supply chain and be placed their product on the EU market. Now, there is a risk there, I think, a quite substantial risk, and we've seen actually evidence of this happening already, that essentially some suppliers are excluded. And the big implication there is what those suppliers don't just go away, they supply potentially other markets with less stringent regulation or less stringent environmental credentials or less willing to pay a price premium for the materials that they're sourcing from. So I think this idea that there should be, and to be fair, on the EU and the EC, there is a program called Team Europe, which is also investing in some of these initiatives to make sure that there is support for some of the producers, but that I would say is probably the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's ultimately required. So it'll be really interesting to see how some of these supply chains do react in terms of those more clear-cut requirements and then this objective really of not just cutting people off from the supply chain entirely.
Cool, so it seems I can have it all. Brilliant. Interestingly, there was a project on Monga Bay that I heard about a couple of years ago called Health in Harmony, who have been going into villages that border rainforests, very sensitive habitats, providing healthcare and seeing deforestation cut by over 90% almost overnight. And they went back to these villages and they said, why has this been such a success? It's because because you listened to what we needed, and that was healthcare. So this idea that people are, that the major driver of deforestation is poverty, it just can't be ignored. Great, on to our next question. How do you fit this idea of bringing emergent markets into the equation, particularly those that rely heavily on trade with the EU? What do you see the impacts outside the EU being with this regulation? Across all criteria, whether it's environmental or social?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the pushback against the EUDR has come from some of those producer governments. Like we've seen a lot of rhetoric and essentially lobbying from Brazil and Indonesia and Malaysia and so forth. There've also been some supportive governments, particularly I think actually some of the cocoa producers, where there is perhaps that slightly more premium access to market. But obviously that's not going to go for all the producers. I think the influence is going to be felt very differently depending on the context of the commodity. So for Brazil, less than 20% now of the Brazil soybean goes to Europe. Used to be a bit higher. Now most of it goes to China or from domestic consumption. So what the EU really does for Brazil, probably not going to make a lot of difference. And actually the systems in place in Brazil already are quite fine for pushing off the bit that's not from the south of Brazil, that's not associated with deforestation, through to the EU supply chain by and large. So I don't think the implications are going to be that great for places like Brazil. Yes, of course, there will be cost implications for Brazilian soy producers, etc. But I don't think they're going to be as great as, say, for example, Côte d'Ivoire, where in contrast, you've got 70 or 80% of the supply chain ultimately destined for some sort of EU market. So that potentially has huge ramifications for that whole supply chain and much less opportunity to say, well, you know, we'll just get that stuff from over here because we can supply the EU market that way. So I think the transition will be very different depending on which commodity and which country we're ultimately talking about. And obviously quite different income statuses exist across those different contexts as well, which is something to think about.
Yeah, very much so. All right, if we just talk about proactive steps, a bit of a call to action now from both of you. What steps can companies like ours take to prepare for future policy, both in sustainability and, you know, environmental responsibility?
I think for me, there's around three things that companies need to be doing in the first thing. So one, the first one is investing in your supply chain. By investing in your supply chain, I also mean traceability, understanding, knowing your supply chain, and working with the supply chain to understand the risks and to address them in a progressive way. I think there's good ways about there to how to include stakeholder consultation or rightholder consultation, involve some of the producers themselves in those conversations rather than being top down. The second thing I think it's important to look at is responsible purchasing practices. How do your practices enable the issues to be resolved in the long term, right? So for example, if we have by giving long-term sourcing contracts to producers, that gives them the confidence to invest in issues to avoid deforestation rather than just supporting them transition to demonstrate that they are not they're not deforesting currently. And the third thing is collaboration. I think working together, having a clear set of requirements for producers in the supply chain aligned, and pooling resources as well, which has proven to be more efficient than to individually going your own way.
Do you mind if I just pick up? You mentioned longer contracts there
as
a means to kind of incentivize that. Have you seen any other good examples of supplier engagement along those lines? Because we've tried a few. We've tried awards.
Yep.
Talk about margins and the buying team run for the hills. Talk about faster invoice payments and the finance team are in a tiz. So yeah, what have you seen work?
Yeah, so I think definitely long-term contracts, I think, work. The second one is definitely involving stakeholders as well into these discussions, right? What would you like to see? What are some of the shared outcomes you want to see? I think that also works pretty well. There was one that just escaped my mind.
And the idea of communicating with suppliers.
Yes.
How have you seen that done particularly well?
I think that's done well. I used to work in Sainsbury's and we did a whole project on living wage and bananas with shared, so sharing that how do our responsible purchasing practices support producers to enable to pay a living wage. And I think what worked well was our buying teams and the banana producers, you know, having a shared plan over how these are going to be achievable, looking at kind of contract length, looking at as well number of access and metrics on how they hit it. So I think some of these things work well. There's also smart responsible contracts. Built in into the contracts the cost of social and environmental mismanage, and then you clarify actions of what happens once an allegation is made. So some of the definitely some ideas.
I like that, laying out clear steps. Yeah. This is what we said we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. So everyone's clear.
Okay. I think from my side, I think be prepared for more regulation would be one aspect. I would say I don't see, particularly on the deforestation risk side, it's been a long time coming, I think, especially the UK side, but I don't know if it's going to go away. So I think be prepared for for more, and that includes potential in expansion scope. They're already talking about expansion in scope within the EUDR, for example. So there may be more coming. I think more generally what I would say is that what we really need ultimately here is more transparency in our supply chains. We, as I said, we don't know where our food comes from, and by and large, and that is problematic when we're trying to deal with crises like climate change and biodiversity loss and human rights, when they're not happening necessarily inside our own UK territory. So more transparency is definitely critical. But it's acting on that transparent information that's the most important thing. There was a company a couple of years ago, I can't remember who it was, but basically said, we're going to become the world's most transparent company ever. And it's just like, well, what for what reason? That's a pointless thing to say. You know, you need to do something with that information. So I think that's where we're going to also see a little bit more of a shift as well, in terms of not this sort of attempt to boycott things just because they're bad, but like you were saying, invest in improvements in the supply chain. That's absolutely key, because otherwise the problems are just going to be shifted elsewhere and we're not going to solve the issue. So yeah, I would say that those are the kind of the things that the businesses should prepare for and be prepared to do.
Thank you. Does anyone in the audience have a question for our panelists?
Thank you. Super useful conversation. I've got two questions and they're a bit garbled in my head, so hopefully you can kind of pick some sense out of this. So the first is around, I guess, we talked about longer term contracts, which sounds really sensible. Do you anticipate or possibly even recommend any other kind of structural changes in procurement strategies? I'm thinking about maybe fewer suppliers and more like consolidated, not necessarily, you know, excluding smaller suppliers, but maybe just fewer overall. And then my second question is on the difference with the FRC. That's super interesting that it's more just about compliance with local land laws. To what extent will compliance with those local land laws provide for anti-deforestation, or actually is that very rarely covered in those laws?
I'll let Noel come in as well on the contract side, but it was interesting hearing from Luke earlier, who was talking from the Mars perspective, where they actually on deforestation, where he was saying that they've gone from 1,000 mills in Indonesia to 100 mills. That's 90% reduction, and he was saying that what we need in these commodities is a decommodification, ultimately a closer relationship with our suppliers, which I agree with. I don't think the EUDR will achieve that decommodification in its own right, but I agree that we need this closer relationship with suppliers. There's good evidence as well that things like gender equity are better if the supply chains are shorter. So that's another consideration as well. The challenge is if you go from 1,000 suppliers to 100 suppliers, then what happens with the 900 suppliers? So you can. It's really important that you're doing other things as well as changing your structure. Best case, you support everybody still some way or another. You know, a good case is make sure you're investing more time, more effort with the suppliers that you've got remaining to make sure that they're also doing broader agricultural good practice. I don't know if you want to come in on that point as well.
Well, you asked one of the things that you could make to make it. I have to say sourcing fair trade certified material is probably the best thing that you can do. But add to it, I think it's, you know, if you're making supply chain shorter or more concentrating, what happens to the other ones? And think about there's hundreds of thousands of smallholder farmers. What role do they play as well there? So
the UK government's logic is that a lot of deforestation is happening illegally. So, and there is a good evidence that a lot of deforestation happens illegally. Doesn't account for all of it. For example, in Brazil, there's the Forest Code, which is one of the longest standing regulations anywhere on protection of forests. That preserves a certain portion of the land. The rest is essentially fair game. So you can deforest that completely legally. These places are deforestation hotspots, so we don't really want that to happen, ideally. There is a case, I think, for saying, let's focus on the legality argument. The legality framing is much easier, of course, also to implement diplomatically. We've seen challenges associated with the EUDR on the World Trade Organization stage because of anti-competition kind of stuff. So it's an easier policy to put through. It should be less controversial from a producer perspective. The key thing really is it actually meaningful when it comes to implementation? Because can we actually track whether something is being produced legally or not? does it really lead to the engagement that ultimately the UK wants to see with suppliers, which will then, I guess, like the example you gave, encourage more of an open and informed conversation about avoiding the broader deforestation activity that's going on just by virtue of making a little bit more connectivity to where you're sourcing from based on the legality front. We'll see whether that happens or not.
This idea of shorter supply chains, or you know, seemingly shorter supply chains, is quite exciting, particularly coming at it from a labour issues point of view. This idea of visibility solves a lot of problems. So this word decommodification, that's my takeaway for today. Great. Does anyone have any last questions?
Do you think decreasing or regenerative agriculture can play a role in ensuring that deforestation does not occur? Because basically, most of the regenerative agriculture would mean that they would have less produce per yield, per hectare yield. So would that in turn more accelerate deforestation in those areas if it was implemented? Or does Fairtrade have any opinion on this? Is it going to work to ensure that their environment, where the produce is made, is also looked after? And it's not just about the increasing the yield so that deforestation doesn't occur while, you know, it does degrade the land to a certain extent.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's an excellent question. I said at Fairtrade, we've been working especially on different areas and coffees, you know, and shade grown coffee and other, let's say, regenerative systems. I think that also goes to the point around how we're going to finance some of that transition. I think a fair trade work with a minimum price and with the sustainability premium that every producer receives when it's sourced on fair trade term, some of that is being invested into these long-term climate transition areas. They've also been going as well, let's say, to improve productivity, to use to do more studies around soil and leaf analysis to apply the right amount of fertilizers, which ultimately makes them better farmers and better systems and better able to be integrated into global systems. But definitely I see that there's the prevention side of thing is how to transition to regenerative agriculture. And one of the takeaways I think from today is let's not look at how to comply this legislation. Let's look how to comply with the spirit of this legislation. And with that, the investment into the supply chains to finance the transition is very, very important.
With that, round of applause for our panelists.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. We've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Manchester in May, Ascot in October, and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. And we look forward to seeing you there.